Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Because I think we're all searching.
There are some people that think that the media would bias.
It's Wednesday, February 15th, 2012, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. I'm Mike McKean, director of the Futures Lab at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Here with me to discuss the latest issues involving the performance of the news media are regular panelist Lee Wilkins and semi-regular panelist and sitting in for Charles Davis, Linda Kraxberger. Lee and Linda are faculty colleagues at the Missouri School of Journalism. On today's program, some British journalists are calling the arrests at the Sun newspaper a witch hunt. And there's talk that the latest bribery allegations could open up News Corp to legal action here in the U.S. Bill O'Reilly defended Ellen DeGeneres on his program last week. Is this the latest example of what some see as a move to the middle by Fox News? Two stories in the New York Times show how the federal government and U.S. tech companies are making it harder for journalists to protect anonymous sources. And a Washington, D.C. television reporter reacts as her children are threatened online and in person because of her investigative series on teen drinking. Let's start in London, where public, parliament, and press have all been transfixed in recent months by allegations of phone hacking at Rupert Murdoch's News of the World. Well, Scotland Yard ratcheted up the pressure this past Saturday, raiding homes and arresting 10 journalists working for another News Corp paper, The Sun. They also took into custody a local police officer, a Ministry of Defense official, and a member of the military. At issue is whether The Sun's journalists bribed public officials. Well, Sun associate editor Trevor Kavanaugh labeled the latest action a witch hunt, and he told Sky News that he felt the cops were treating his staff like members of an organized crime gang.
If it's there, police don't really have much alternative but to investigate it, do they?
Look, they don't have much alternative but to investigate it, but they don't need either, since they have these millions of documents and emails and other receipts, to go raiding people at 7 o'clock in the morning before they're up and about, and in such heavy-handed proportions. I mean, look, we've got 30 arrests so far. Not a single charge has been made. No one's appeared in court. No one's been convicted. They're all innocent until proved guilty. And yet, their lives are on hold. Their careers have potentially been ruined. Okay, people will say, we deserve it. Maybe that might be an argument, but I don't believe it's true.
Of course, you might expect an editor whose colleagues had just been arrested to criticize the police, but journalists outside the News Corp family have also accused the police, parliament, and the prime minister's government of, quote, threatening the free press in Great Britain. Richard Littlejohn, for example, over at the Daily Mail, compared Scotland Yard to the East German Stasi or the Gestapo. Well, Lee, I mean, nobody is trying to defend, I don't think, bribery or hacking. Those things are wrong, and if somebody did it, they should be prosecuted. But I wonder what you make of this notion that seems to have gotten quite a bit of traction in the British press that the police went too far.
I don't make very much of it. I don't think that the police in this case did go too far. One of the background pieces of this is that police are acting on emails that are actually being turned over to them by Rupert Murdoch's organization. And there's this internal standards committee. I've forgotten exactly what it's called. But, you know, their task has been to go through, I think, literally tens of thousands, if not millions of emails, and to turn over things that might be problematic. I think the reason that folks have acted as vociferously as they have is, I suspect this is one of those ones, to coin a cliche, where if there's smoke, there really is fire, and it's going to become extremely damaging the more that they find.
I guess that's obviously that could be true. On the other hand, as the editor suggests, nobody's been charged with anything. The allegations have not been made public. And if you believe the accounts in the press, these people were rousted out of bed at 7 o'clock in the morning. Their drawers were rifled through. Their cars were searched. They were thrown in jail. It seems like perhaps just a touch much, given the fact that these reporters are not a flight risk, at least.
Well,
that's how it's being portrayed. Yeah. And, you know, whenever you're on the outside looking in, even as a journalist on the outside looking in, it's easy to apply your lens to the particular situation. In this case, if you wanted to grab somebody's email before they could delete it, if you wanted to find the documents on their computer before they caught word that a raid was going to happen, you would have to. I mean, that 7 a.m. thing is not unusual, and it's not unique to journalists. And so I find it just a little bit of hypocrisy on the part of journalists to call it, you know, Gestapo tactics in this particular case and never to have called that out in other cases in which police are doing an investigation and somebody hasn't yet been charged.
The other thing about this is, while it's true that there have been all these arrests, there have been no charges and no one has been convicted, News Corp and Murdoch have paid an enormous number of the equivalent of American dollars, millions of dollars in restitution to people who have been the subject of the phone hacking scandal. So there is, at least to me, there's an admission of wrongdoing, even if it hasn't occurred in a court of law.
But these are two different cases, theoretically at least. Phone hacking supposedly happened at one newspaper, the bribery at another. And so you can't necessarily taint the reporters accused of, quote, bribery with what's gone wrong at the other paper, can you?
Well, I think in some ways you can, because part of the phone hacking scandal did include some allegations of bribery of Scotland Yard. And there, I think there is the sense that while the two papers may not be in collusion, okay, in that sense, that this is a systemic ethical legal problem in News Corp, and particularly because News Corp is organized the way it is, it's highly unlikely that people higher up the chain of command were unaware of what was going on in both papers.
Of course, it wouldn't be surprisingly for the folks at the tabloids in Britain to maybe just exaggerate a hair, but I did think it was interesting. The columnist Littlejohn said one of the Sun reporters that was questioned allegedly was questioned about, quote, a 50-pound bill for lunch with police sources. And he says if every hack who's ever bought a sandwich and mm-hmm. beer for a copper is guilty of bribery, they'll have to build more prisons. So I'm wondering whether or not we know how low the ethical standards went in terms of bribery, or if this is just common practice of, you know, giving a little money, buying a meal, buying a beer to get some information from a friendly source.
I don't know what's common in Britain. I do know that in the United States, we actually spend a fair amount of time talking with at least our students about, you know, can you be bought for a cup of coffee? Let's get this straight. But, you know, the shoe is on the other foot. Mm-hmm. In the federal government, there are actual regulations. It's okay for me to buy a federal employee lunch, providing it's below a certain amount. The assumption is that my federal government can't be bought for 10 bucks or 15 bucks. But after that, I mean, that's a reason that there are rules for these sorts of things, so you don't wind up worrying about whether or not, you know, buying a pint of Guinness is the equivalent of a bribe.
I mean, we do argue, Linda, about the ethics of what you can accept from a source or give to a source for information. But it seems to me, at least when we're talking about legalities, it's kind of funny if this claim is true, that one mm-hmm. of the reporters is being accused of illegality for buying a lunch and a beer for a cop, when in this country, television networks, in the past at least, have paid huge sums of money to get sources to show up on camera exclusively. Legal versus ethical is a pretty interesting distinction, I think.
Oh, I think it's a very interesting distinction, and one that we frequently will talk about, the legality versus the ethics of a particular situation. In this case, buying a source a cup of coffee or a lunch or a pint, I mean, that is just about chatting up your sources, and it's not about getting your sources drunk so that they're more loose-lipped, but I wouldn't put it past them.
One of the other accusations that's coming out of from other members of the media in Great Britain this week is that perhaps this whole problem with, as you said, Lee, with the Murdoch folks turning over all kinds of records to the authorities is essentially a way, Linda, for the higher-ups in the corporation to throw their underlings under the bus to protect their own corporate interests.
I wouldn't put it past them. I mean, there's enough sketchiness around all of the previous things that have come out about News Corp that I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't want to believe that about a reputable news organization. But it seems to me that, you know, when push comes to shove, we know people who've had even held noble ideas that have managed to push other people out there in front of the traffic to try to divert attention from themselves. And I don't think that would be highly unusual in this case.
Well, we're told, Lee, that Rupert Murdoch is traveling sometime this week to London, where he's supposed to reassure the folks at the Sun that their jobs are okay and that they're not going to throw this newspaper or their employees under the bus. But I got to think that from what some people are saying internally, at least, that might be a pretty hostile audience.
I think it will be a hostile audience, and to coin a sports metaphor, it's when the general manager of the Denver Broncos comes out and says, "I have complete faith in the coach." You know that within the month, that guy is going to be gone. You know, we sort of call that the dreaded vote of confidence. And Rupert Murdoch has lied to Parliament. I mean, I don't think there's any dispute about that. There's a whole string of things. So why would any employee of his believe him at this point? I just can't imagine.
Of course, the biggest financial threat so far, you know, has been in Great Britain. But there's some concern now that because of the bribery allegations that there could be U.S. prosecutions. And in fact, you know, we already know that the Attorney General's Office, the Justice Department, has been looking into this. The SEC has been looking into whether or not News Corp, which is headquartered in New York, not in London, may be violating the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. And that could really lead to some serious fines and trouble for the company here.
It could lead to some serious fines and trouble. And it's going to require somebody with a little bit of backbone to do that prosecution, if indeed that prosecution is warranted. At least according to some of the stuff, Mike, that we've got on the blog, some of the folks from Great Britain are coming to the U.S. either this week or next to sort of begin that part of the investigation. And of course, that tangles up News Corp, but it also tangles up the Wall Street Journal. So there are real journalistic, if you will, implications here, not just in terms of the corporate side of News Corp, but what individual publications or media outlets are going to do about all of this.
And just to be a little more specific about that, one of the lawyers who actually represented some of the phone hacking victims in the UK is coming over to the US. And although he isn't denying or acknowledging it yet, he apparently is coming here with the possibility of filing a civil suit involving some sort of wrongdoing by News Corp in the US. And that, again, knowing how civil suits can be handled in the United States, could put them at a great jeopardy for some liability there, too. Well, let's move on to another story that involves News Corp. At first blush, this claim may sound absurd to some of our listeners and viewers, but there are some pundits who say they've noticed a relatively recent move by Fox News to tack to the center in its political coverage. The latest example that they point to is Bill O'Reilly's decision last Thursday night to take on the group 1 Million Moms. That organization is upset that JCPenney has hired openly lesbian comedian and TV talk show host Ellen DeGeneres as its spokeswoman.
The essential question is that a group, a conservative group in this country, is asking a private company to fire an American citizen based upon her lifestyle. And I don't think that's correct. I don't have any problem with you, Sandy, or any of the million moms not shopping at JCPenney. You don't want to shop there because you don't believe the message that they're sending by hiring Ellen is a good message. More power to you. That is your decision and your right as an American. But to come out and demand the woman be fired, that's wrong.
I think a lot of people, including Ellen DeGeneres herself, were a little bit surprised by this sort of vigorous defense from Bill O'Reilly. And in fact, on her own TV show, she said, if you want to use my employee discount card, Bill, when you go to JCPenney's, you're welcome to it. I wonder if you're a little bit surprised that Bill O'Reilly, Linda, defended Ellen DeGeneres so vociferously.
I'm a little bit surprised. But on the other hand, and I can't think of a specific example here, John O'Reilly is his own guy, and he often comes out with a different tack than what you would think as the general Fox News spin on things. And so this theme that he has about a particular interest group pushing for one person's pushing against an American business company is not an unfamiliar theme for him.
I mean, he does try to come off as the sort of populist conservative. Does this surprise you, Lee, that he would defend Ellen DeGeneres against a conservative female group, probably a group that watches his program quite regularly?
I don't know if I'd say surprised, but Mike, I woke up on the cynical side this morning. I actually think that the first thing we've talked about is connected to this. I think that Fox realizes that it could potentially be in deep trouble, and that's financial as well as in a lot of other ways. And so what's one way that you begin to mitigate that? You start offending fewer people, especially fewer people who have some power. And Ellen DeGeneres, although she does not have a lot of power individually, represents a group of people that do have some power and do have some political clout, especially in the Obama administration, and that Fox is pretty much pilloried up until quite recently. So I see more connections there than might meet the eye, and maybe that is completely cynical on my part, but I don't think so.
I mean, we certainly are cynical more often than not on this program, and often proven correct, ultimately. But I mean, I have to say, I do think that it was, whether or not it was calculated, it was certainly a defense that was unexpected, and I think a very fine defense of some American principles by someone I wouldn't have expected to have heard it from.
Well, I mean, in a way, it's sort of consistent with the sort of mantra about the Catholic Church shouldn't be asked to violate its principles regarding contraception, because that's a religious freedom thing. So when he comes out and says that, you know, you have the freedom to boycott, an interesting British tradition in and of itself, but what you don't have the freedom to do is to criticize a capitalistic decision in this way. Right. I kind of find that in a way sort of all of the same piece of oddly reasoned cloth.
There are, Linda, folks who are putting this latest sort of example into the context of some other things that Fox News has been doing over the past several months. For example, last fall, Roger Ailes, who's the boss at Fox News, told Howard Kurtz, the media analyst, that he was, quote, making a course correction, that he was getting rid of Glenn Beck. He didn't say this in so many words. Mm-hmm. He got rid of Glenn Beck. He's been promoting sort of the straight news talent more. He's been encouraging his reporters, supposedly, at these debates and in other venues to ask really tough questions of the Republican presidential candidates. In fact, some folks on the right are saying that Fox News is tacking to the left just to stay on top of the ratings. Seems like a bit of a stretch to me. I don't know what you think about
that. It seems like a wild stretch to me. But I you just never know. I mean, if you were looking at all the numbers coming in and you saw that, let's just, I'm going to take an extreme example, and I don't know that this for a fact, but if you saw that CNN maybe was picking up more moderate viewers and that there was increasing dissatisfaction politically with extreme points of view on either the right or the left, as a business, I mean, Fox strategically put itself in the right because it saw that as a niche that wasn't being fulfilled. For years, it's fulfilled that role because that was not being fulfilled. If it sees that there's a centrist area in 24-hour cable television that is lacking now, and if it sees the mood of the country saying we want more centrist type of points of view, it wouldn't be impossible that that decision would be made.
And I don't think, Lee, that the media are just sort of making up this story. For example, at CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference that was held in Washington last week, there were a bunch of activists who were complaining vocally about Fox News. They complained about Ailes hiring an openly gay liberal activist as one of their news contributors. They've said for a long time that some of the folks over at Fox News are now in the back pocket or shilling for Mitt Romney, that they're caving in to Media Matters, the liberal media watchdog that's been trying to bring down Fox. So I just wonder if, again, maybe it's not a total shift to the center, but there are some things that are upsetting conservatives about whatever it is that Fox is doing.
I think there are things that are upsetting conservatives, and as we were saying before the show, the center, as it turns out, is a commodious space. You know, there's lots of room in there. And so if Fox is, in fact, tacking that way, I agree with Linda, because of how the network came to be, I think this is in part a business decision. I also think that Fox itself, as it has become more powerful, has received ever more critique. Some of it, in my way of thinking, very fact-based. And I think they're having more and more trouble responding to that. The other thing that may be going on for Fox, or maybe not, is there are issues now where the conservatives are actually splitting into different camps themselves. And so you might displease one group of, quote, politically conservative people, but not displease another group of politically conservative people, at least as they self-identify.
Still, Linda, shouldn't we applaud Fox News, or for that matter, MSNBC, if they actually are, as some people suggest, moving toward the middle, being more fair and less mean in their programming? Shouldn't we be happy for that?
I would be very happy if that was the total – if that was what it was about, if it was about this sort of pure notion of general of journalism and trying to be fair. My guess is it's less about a pure notion and a sense of being fair as it is a marketing decision to capitalize on what people are complaining about or not complaining about. The idea of being fair really is should be immune to complaints because I don't like it, because somebody doesn't happen to like your idea of what fair is.
Our third issue this week, as we need to move on here, involves a couple of stories at the New York Times over the weekend about how government and technology companies are making it really hard for journalists to keep their anonymous sources anonymous. One of the stories was by Adam Liptak, and he talks about, for example, Lee, how he perceives it, at least and other critics perceive it, that the Obama administration has actually made prosecuting government leakers routine, even more so than Bush or anyone before him.
Well, according to the story, which is on the blog, and I encourage people to read it, it's not just that the Obama administration is prosecuting more people for leaks. It's prosecuting more people by orders of magnitude. Now, some of that may be the sort of the things that have, you know, walked in. I mean, we've got WikiLeaks, and, you know, there are a few sort of big things like that that have come of age. But I also think that it's interesting that we have this supposedly somewhat centrist Democratic administration that and one time argues for openness, mm-hmm. but at the same time is willing to punish government folks who leak. And one of the things that the literature that we know as scholars about that is that people who whistleblow first internally. We are the whistleblowing court of last resort. So when people are leaking to us, it isn't because they haven't tried to go to their boss or go to their boss's boss and somehow fix what they believe is wrong. And that's the part of it that – well, there are many parts of it that concern me, but that's one of the central parts of it that concern me, because I'm not sure how either the government or we are going to go get around that.
Well, and Linda, the other key part of this story was how the government can use technology increasingly mm-hmm. to get at sources, whether it's looking at your phone records, whether it's looking at your email, your credit cards, your purchases of airline tickets, hacking your cell phones, might I suggest. All this technology is there, and it's leading to what one judge they quoted in the story as saying that reporters might find themselves contacting sources the way I understand drug dealers to reach theirs, by use of clandestine cell phones and meeting in darkened doorways. Is it really coming to that because of the technology?
I don't know if it – I think there are too many lazy reporters that would to make it actually come to that in terms of the technology. But I do think serious reporters who are working on very serious stories would be would find their email. They would want to get off the grid as quickly as possible when they're working with a government source. I can't imagine a serious investigative journalist doing the bulk of their work via email or via traceable means.
And some of these tactics, although they sound new because of technology, the tobacco industry, when it was mm-hmm. fighting that set of cases, that set of public health cases, actually subpoenaed journalists' tax returns because they wanted to see where the travel expenses had been so that they could sort of trace back, oh, well, this journalist was in Raleigh, North Carolina, and this source was also in Raleigh, North Carolina. Therefore, this journalist must have been talking to this source. So some of this has a long and particularly sort of chancy history. It's not just technology-based.
But some of it does have a new technology twist. We see big internet companies cooperating with law enforcement. We even saw a piece in the Times this past weekend in the Bits blog, their technology blog, about how one company that makes an iPhone social media app is actually gathering all of people's address book information off their phone without telling them and storing it on servers where they and law enforcement people could get access to it. So there is a technology component that's rather troubling, I think.
Well, and that same story said that one of the things about all of this that is a problem for government is that if you're a government person and you're captured, oh, say, in the Arab Spring, you know, Hillary Clinton is lobbying for an app that will essentially act as a kill switch and delete all of your contacts with one press of the button so that you don't get yourself into trouble the way that journalists did get people killed in Tiananmen Square. Mm-hmm.
But I suspect it's not just in China where we have to worry about the government hacking into our electronic lives. I suspect our government's pretty adept at it, too. Well, we often talk about how social media are a power for good around the world, giving voice, for example, to the pro-democracy demonstrators in Iran or Egypt or Syria, China, other places. But we close this week's program with a disturbing example, I think, of social media as a vehicle for intimidation. The case involves Washington, D.C. television reporter Andrea McCarron and her family. McCarron has been investigating underage drinking, including businesses that make it easy for D.C. teens to purchase alcohol. Well, it wasn't long before angry students started attacking McCarron personally on Facebook, saying things like, "You can't try and take away something that teens love without retaliation." Then her high school-aged children started receiving taunts and threats. McCarron decided to remove her face and voice from her latest story and hand over the reins to WUSA colleague Derek McGinty.
"We never thought we could stop teenagers from drinking. We just want to wake up the folks whose job it is to make it harder for you to screw up. Maybe get some kids to calculate that the risk just isn't worth the trouble. Perhaps even save some lives. Because all of us around here learned a long time ago there are much worse things than a few nasty names."
Linda, you've been around television news for a long time, and I can't recall very many examples of local television reporters having them and their families harassed this way, and certainly with the social media technologies to leverage as well.
I haven't seen much in that way. I mean, I've seen, ongoing sort of legal discussions between a reporter and a business and that kind of interaction, but not this sort of full court press kind of by all kinds of teens. On the other hand, I will say this, while it's disturbing to me, I think it's indicative of a generation that is growing up in social media and feel no shame at all to just hit the send button and to say really nasty things in a digital way that they wouldn't say in a face-to-face forum.
I don't know, Lee, whether we can say, that this was somehow really a threat to their physical safety. And yet, not only did the students use Facebook to attack the reporter, but they went after her kids in high school, taunting them. They sent a group out notes saying, "Big party at their house," and they had to call in the police. The students stayed home for a while. They're back now and say everything's getting better. But that seems like a really ratcheting up that kind of cyberbullying.
It is ratcheting up cyberbullying, but I agree with Linda. This is part and parcel of the culture that we're living in. And one part of me wants to say, where are your parents? Mm-hmm. And why are your parents not monitoring what you're doing online? And another part of me wants to say, I'm not sure. This is different in quality, but not in kind, to the post that you could see on the Columbia Tribune, for example, where somebody says to the reporter who's written a story that person doesn't like, "Oh, well, your parents weren't married," in not those words. Mm-hmm. So I, and we've got this mean level of discourse. And I think young people who don't have a lot of governors are kind of copying what they see the elders doing.
And I suppose we could be cynical and say it's sweeps month in February and the television station is deciding to pull their reporter off the story just to increase their ratings. But I don't think so
I think that's a really rare case. I just think this is a lifetime movie. I think, we've seen other examples of extreme high school teenage behavior, and this is another one of those.
Well, with that, we're going to have to leave you for this week. Thanks to Lee and Linda for their analysis. Thanks to our technical crew, RJI's Travis McMillan, KBIA's Pat Akers, and student producer Chelsea Myers. And thank you for watching or listening. Want to read more about today's topics? You can visit our page on KBIA.org. You'll find it under the talk show's menu. We'd also like to hear from you via email, views@KBIA.org. I'm Mike McKean. Please join us again next Wednesday for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.